Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. So we're here today at Jack Straw Studio, and it's Thursday, August 6, 2015, and I'm here with Tim Harris, the founder and director of Real Change, and I'm Josephine Ensign. And Tim, as we talked a little bit about, this is for the Skid Road Project, which is oral history project to kind of increase an understanding of the complexity of charity, especially healthcare, but health very widely. Understood in King County. So the first kind of question I have for you is, what led you to the work that you do?
It's always felt very natural to me. I ran away from home when I was 17. I was in a difficult family that didn't work very well. I got arrested for smoking pot. This was during 10th grade. It was the year that I managed to get kicked out of all three high schools in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And they sent me to a drug counselor who told me that I wasn't the problem, my family was, and I needed to get out as soon as I could. So that was when I was 17, and I was homeless for a little while, but mostly I just bounced around in cheap places to live for a couple of years while I worked a number of jobs. And by the time I went into the Air Force, when I was 18, late 18, I was living in basically Sioux Falls' version of Skid Road. My SRO was above the Aero Bar and across the street from the Nashville Club. So that's a sort of an element that has always been part of me. And I went into the Air Force, and even though I'd been a high school dropout, I got myself into college. I started going to community college at night and got accepted to UMass Amherst. Majored in social thought, political economy, minored in journalism. And I started my first newspaper when I was in college. It was a monthly kind of anarchist rag called Critical Times. And when I graduated, I moved to Boston, and I got involved with homeless organizing. There were some people in Boston, Jim Stewart, who was the pastor at First Church Cambridge, and Stuart Guernsey, who was another minister that was worked in the Dorchester Roxbury area, and they were sort of Mitch Snyder's Northeast lieutenants. So they were very involved in a kind of a direct action homeless organizing that very much appealed to me. So I threw myself into that. I think my real conversion experience, well, even when I was in college, I went to D.C. and got arrested for one of Mitch Snyder's fasts. It was a 52-day fast, I think, where he almost died, and there was a mass arrest to support that of like 90 people, and I was part of that and spent 3 days in D.C. Central cell block because we were too pure to bail ourselves out. And that was really my first engagement formally with the issue of homelessness, but I was drawn to it, I think, because of my personal history. I've always seen myself as an outsider and been comfortable with poor folks, people who are on the edge. I just kind of have an affinity there personally. So when I was in Boston, I got involved with a thing called Homefront 88, which was a homeless person's survival encampment slash protest encampment. It started off as a protest encampment in front of the State House in Boston for about a week. It moved over across the street to the Boston Common for a period, and then it went to City Hall and stayed there for close to 3 months. And I was sort of their unofficial organizer. I wasn't getting paid for it, but I was there, and I saw myself as doing a kind of an immersion journalism thing to tell the story about the encampment, but I quickly morphed into an organizer slash resource person for them. And I was very close to that encampment and really saw some really awful stuff and some really heroic stuff, you know, people who were really struggling but had found this common purpose and were rising to the occasion and dealing with their personal difficulties and personal flaws, and that was all part of the mix. And that was what I wanted to do. I decided that that was just, this is home for me. So I wound up, also during this time, I'd started editing something called Street Magazine in Boston, which was a irregular kind of anarchist publication. We were actually living in, there were three of us, and we were actually living in a squat while we were publishing this. And then there was a split where me and the art director decided we were going to take it over from the publisher, and we stole the Mac Plus that we produced it on and moved to a new house. So that's what my life was like back in those days. There was a lot of drama. And I did that for a while. I was editor of that, and I got hired by Boston Jobs with Peace to be their director, which was ridiculous because I was the only staff person. But the great thing about it was that they were attracted to the energy that I brought to it. They wanted to do the direct action homeless organizing thing. They supported us in that. So I had this kind of minor institutional platform from which I could do direct action organizing with homeless folks. And the thing about Jobs with Peace was that I got to – their whole thing was to do organizing with very poor people and make the connections to federal budget priorities and the military budget in particular. And that came naturally to me. So it was this sort of platform to talk politics, national priorities, while doing direct action organizing with homeless people. And I started a street newspaper while I was doing that. In 92, I started Spare Change in Boston. And that was – that paper was an answer to a question. I'd been doing – this sort of street-level organizing, doing homeless encampments, protest encampments, civil rights organizing. But it was generally pretty reactive, and I felt like we were getting in the papers, we were making noise, and we were drawing attention to the issue, but I didn't feel like we were building really anything. And I was interested in the question of how do you create institutional power within a group of people that's more or less by definition transient, and all of the problems that came along with that. And another piece of that was that, you know, my value was, or one of my values was, that homeless people needed to be involved as the organizers, and that they needed to have control over that process, and that it should be bottom up and controlled by the people who were most affected. And that was hard to do in practice because the horizon for social justice organizing, economic justice organizing, is really long and uncertain. And people's needs that I was organizing were very immediate and very dire. So in the late 80s, Street News began in New York, which is widely regarded as the seminal paper of the modern street paper movement. And I saw that and started thinking about it. We actually had a brief experiment with Street Magazine in 90 or 91 to have homeless folks sell that on the streets of Boston, which never really quite took off. But I decided that a street paper modeled more or less on what they had done in New York, but political really as a basis, as a foundation for organizing and controlled by the homeless folks who were involved in it, was an answer to a lot of the questions that I was wrestling with. So I started that paper. And it took off like a rocket. It was the right idea at the right time.
And what was the name of
it? It was called Spare Change.
Oh, that was a Spare Change.
It was called Spare Change. And, you know, the issue with that paper was that I was very much in my Alinskyist organizer period, and my idea was that my role was as a facilitator and coach, but not a decision maker, that all of the decisions in the project needed to be made by the homeless people who were involved. And my role was to cultivate leadership and help them do that effectively, but not be a decision maker. And, you know, repeatedly I had the experience, this actually happened to me three times with three different projects around that period before I got the message. Repeatedly what would happen is I would create this organization of homeless people, and inevitably some sort of borderline personality disordered charismatic sociopath would walk into the power vacuum that I had created and take the organization over and create chaos. And I would be in the position of trying to deal with that without being in control. Which was an untenable position. And around the third time it happened, I finally, you know, woke up and decided that there was something fundamentally wrong with that model and that that wasn't going to work. And around that time, I got fired from Spare Change by the members of Spare Change. They'd tried to fire me before, and I'd turned the vote around into basically a vote of confidence for me as their organizer. So I survived the first attempt. But the guy who was my nemesis just waited for a meeting that I wasn't at and reintroduced it and got the vote. And by that time, I was burnt out. I was just burnt out and tired. And I was like, you know, fine. I still have my job, but I would have had to reinvent the organization, and I didn't have it in me at that point. So I resigned, and worked with worked with the board of Jobs with Peace to try to set them up for success and spinning off and being independent as much as they could. During this period, the guy's name was Tim. He was also named Tim. Mm. This gets told as the tale of two Tims. He actually broke in one night and stole all the computers and left a message on the voicemail saying, you know, screw you. The only reason I didn't take the copy or two was I couldn't carry it. And then I think when he started to sober up around 6:37 in the morning, he realized that that was a fatal mistake in his plan, and he turned himself into the police. So I got this, like, 7 a.m. call from the Cambridge police saying, we got this guy here who says that he's stolen all your computers. Can you confirm? And by then, he'd, like, fenced them off. So I re-engaged and helped them get their computers back. They were insured, and helped get them set up. But I needed to move on. So I spent about a year just doing kind of political odd jobs, organizing odd jobs in Boston. And my idea was that I was going to move somewhere else and start another street paper and somehow resolve the power issue that I'd been struggling with. And I knew what I didn't want to do. I knew that what I had been doing wasn't working, but it was far less clear on how to positively express that, what that meant in terms of what I should be doing, what a more viable model would look like. So I basically came to Seattle looking to resolve that question, knowing that I wanted to start another street paper, knowing that a street paper was a really powerful foundation for doing organizing with homeless folks and resolved some of the contradictions that I'd been wrestling with, but really kind of being unclear on what the structure of it was going to be. So I moved here, and
that was what year?
That was March of 94. Okay. When I moved here, and we got the first issue out on the street by August 20th.
So fairly quickly. And why Seattle?
It was one of those accidents, you know. I mean, part of it was rational choice, but part of it was just pure personal accident. My ex-wife and I had been here visiting. At the time, she was my wife. Had been here visiting because she had family in the area. She had a new MSW from Boston University and was looking to get out of Boston because in Boston, everybody's got an advanced mm-hmm. degree and an MSW doesn't take you very far. So she was looking to move somewhere, and I was looking to move somewhere. And we'd been to Seattle visiting some of her relatives, and we really liked it. And I looked around, and you know, the Homestead Organizing Project was a couple of years, maybe a year past the big Pacific Hotel occupation downtown, where more than 100 homeless people physically took over a hotel and occupied it for several weeks before it got turned over to a nonprofit housing developer. Cher was doing their tent cities. There was a homeless-run art gallery at the corner of 2nd and Bell, about a block from where our office was eventually located. And there wasn't a street paper, so there was a lot of interesting organizing going on that I was attracted to. And it just looked like the kind of a city that a street paper would do well in.
So then how did you figure out the model that you like have settled into with it?
You know, I really wrestled with that initially, you know, because when I came here and I spent the first couple of months just introducing myself around and talking to people who are leaders around housing and homelessness and asking them who else I should talk to. And I was pretty frank about it, you know, and I would tell them that I was struggling with this, and sometimes, you know, pretty often what I would hear was, well, you should get a group of homeless people together and ask them what you should do. And I was like, no, you don't get it. I've done that. That's not right. Where I want to go with this. And then I was talking to this one organizer. God, I can't believe I'm forgetting her name. Watkins. Watkins? Helena. Helena Stevens. And she was a really experienced organizer, African-American woman. I forget who she was affiliated with. And I was telling her about my dilemma, and she looked at me and she said, "You're the one who's doing this. You need to make decisions." And it was kind of this aha moment for me. It was like, wait a minute, you know, I don't have to be so worked up about my own privilege to take myself out of the power equation, you know? And what I eventually landed at that was that, I mean, my previous understanding was that my role as the organizer was to be a kind of a conduit for other people's power and not have power myself. And what I arrived at was that that was a dodge, that that was really a cop-out, and that as the organizer, I had responsibility for what happened in the organization, that if I didn't take responsibility, people were going to get hurt, and that that was on me, that I needed to be the place where the buck stopped, and that empowerment was, you know, great and still the object. But that it was my job to create the parameters within which that would operate. And it was also when I began to think through what it meant to have a cross-class organization, to have an organization that, I mean, there's like two models that you usually find in organizations that work around homelessness. You've got the organization that has a sort of a professional middle-class culture, and you've got a bunch of college-educated advocates, and they involve homeless people to some extent, but for the most part, that winds up looking kind of tokenistic. And then on the other side, you've got the grassroots homeless empowerment organization that is full of poor people making decisions, but they are suspicious of middle class people. They are reluctant to share power with them, and as a result, they wind up being kind of isolated in what they're able to do and stymied in their alliances, and it keeps them from being the powerful organizations that they could be. And I began to understand that the challenge was to create a cross-class organization where people were fully participating from all different kinds of class backgrounds and bringing their assets to the table to the maximum extent possible while not stepping on each other's toes too much, you know, sort of acknowledging that there are cultural differences and differences in the way that people approach things and that, you know, they all have their strengths and weaknesses, and they need to be able to work together. And real change has, you know, over the years developed into really a kind of a laboratory of how to do that, how to bring people together across class and have everybody fully participating in an organization that sees itself intentionally as a cross-class organization and builds power from that.
So what are some of the concrete ways that you've gone about doing that?
I mean, we've had – well, I mean, there's sort of two answers to that. One is, you know, some of the successes that we've had, and another is how do we engage people. So, you know, we've evolved into a pretty powerful organization. We're a community institution that's been around for a long time. We publish every week. We sell about 12,000 copies. We have, on a typical month, about 325 vendors on average that are selling the paper, about 800 over the course of the year. We're respected as a newspaper. We have a professional journalism staff. This year, we got 12 first-place awards from the Washington Press Association, 2 first-place awards from the Society of Professional Journalists. So we're an award-winning newspaper with quality content. And we're an organizing project. It was initiated as an organizing project, and we've always understood ourselves to not just simply be about creating employment opportunity, but to be about organizing and more fundamentally about building relationships and being a vehicle for people to build relationships. So there's all sorts of ways that the vendors are engaged within the organization. For example, they elect their own vendor representatives. So we have these peer positions that are vendor elected that actually have the power to overturn staff decisions on suspensions or terminations of the right to sell the paper. The appeal board is vendors, and they have power around that, and they're leaders within the organization. We have a editorial committee that we have the professional news staff, but at the same time we have an editorial committee of vendors and formerly homeless people that meet weekly to talk about what kind of stories we should be covering from their experience, what's on their radar, how does the coverage and the last issue resonate with them. You know, it's kind of our way of dealing with that issue of how do you produce a readable quality newspaper and at the same time have homeless folks involved and informing that content. We have a Real Change Organizing Committee, which meets every 2 weeks and is really how we pull vendors into our organizing work, and they really choose what issues we wind up taking up and working on and supporting work of other organizations that we're allied with. So vendors wind up testifying at City Hall and in Olympia, and being a real public voice and presence at a lot of things. And we've got a real solid core of people who are highly engaged in the advocacy and the organizing and taking leadership roles there. We have a Homeless Speakers Bureau that is made up of vendors who have been trained in public speaking and how to tell their story effectively and talk about homelessness. And they go out and talk to schools and churches and civic organizations. And, you know, we're always asking ourselves the question, it's always a work in progress of, you know, how do we authentically involve the vendors throughout the organization? We have vendors on our board. So, you know, it's really approaching that question of homeless empowerment in a way that's about being cross-class. And, you know, we've had a number of fairly stunning wins, you know. Back 5-6 years ago, I'm not exactly sure when it was. It was in the mid-late 80s, 87, no, 90s. No, 2000s. My decades get confused. Right. My decades get confused. It was like 2008, 2009. That was when the city tried to make panhandling illegal.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
And we fought back on that with a bunch of other people, but we led that and we were able to win on that. And that almost never happens. And I think a big part of the reason that we were able to win was that over the last nearly two decades at that point, it was more than 15 years anyway, we had built this base of readers. And I think people in Seattle understand homelessness differently than they did two decades ago, just through the association with the vendors and reading the paper. I think that there's a lot more empathy out there, and that that's built on relationships that people have formed. I think people in this city see homelessness differently, and that's the real reason we were able to win that campaign. We geared up when the city wanted to build a new municipal jail. We saw that as part of the pattern of criminalizing homelessness and poverty crime. And we pushed back against that with an initiative campaign. And that happened over the course of elections, mayoral elections and city council. When we began that campaign, everybody saw the jail as being inevitable. It was hard to even get friendly politicians to come out against the jail because they just saw it as this kind of unstoppable freight train. And we turned that from a conversation about inevitability and where they were going to site the thing. It was the city was approaching it as sort of this conversation about zoning and where it was going to be, taking whether they were going to build it as a given. And we turned that into a conversation about disproportionality and incarceration and criminal justice and race and class. And over the course of that election, the dynamic flipped, and the only people who were supporting the new jail by the end of it were Mayor Nichols and Tom Carr, and they got booted out of office. And a whole new crop of people came in, and between Dan Satterberg and Pete Holmes and Mike McGinn, the new jail was killed, and they wound up signing an agreement with King County to continue using their facilities until 2040. So we've been able to do some really significant things, and it's because we've built that broad grassroots power that, you know, is grounded in organized homeless folks that we're involved with. But also the whole broader community of decent people in Seattle who care and have resources that they can bring to the issues.
So you see that a lot just in terms of people starting to have relationships with the vendors and wherever
it's really
going about.
That relationship piece is really the core of what Real Change is about. And it's the piece that still, after all these years, I'm most kind of awestruck by, you know. I mean, we get people who come in and start selling the paper, and, you know, not always, but a lot of times these are people who are at a pretty low place in their lives, you know. They've come to a fairly isolated place. A lot of times they've burnt a lot of bridges. They don't have a lot of human connection. And they don't have a sense of possibility, and, you know, they feel stuck and kind of paralyzed where they are. And when they start selling the paper, a lot of times they find that they have, you know, a certain amount of personal agency. You know, they can come in, they can get 20 papers, they can go out and sell them, they've got 30, 40, 50 bucks from that. They come back, they reinvest in the paper. There's this real direct relationship between effort and reward, and it's on their terms, you know, so they're able to deal with whatever else they've got going on in their life. And, you know, people can still, if they've got addictions and stuff going on, that's not really an issue for us as long as they're able to abide by our code of conduct and not have it be a problem while they're selling the paper. So it's this opening and this place where people can begin to experience a greater degree of control over their lives. And then the next thing that happens is they start forming relationships. You know, we encourage people to find a place that they kind of cultivate as their spot. And, you know, because people are people and they tend to be in their various grooves, you know, they see the same people over and over again and they build relationships with them. And those are authentic, caring relationships, you know. They wind up having real conversations about what's going on in their lives and they find themselves sort of embedded in this network of human relationships, which winds up being really life-changing for a lot of people. And they come to see their place in the world differently. They come to see their personal potential differently. And you know, one of the cool things that I've seen over and over is that without us ever communicating you know, your addiction is a bad thing, because we don't do that. We don't make value judgments around that, and we don't assume that we know what's best for people. What often winds up happening is after people become more sort of in relationship to the community and they start building a stronger sense of their own potential, their sense of who they are doesn't square with the negative behaviors anymore, and they look to, you know, get sober or get off drug, get off heroin or get off crack or whatever their issue is. We see that over and over and over again, you know. I think that really people need that space to be able to value themselves before they can move on from the addiction, and real change often provides the opportunity for that to happen.
Nice. So what kinds of interfaces do you have with healthcare for them in terms of when they have health issues or they have addiction issues that they're wanting to deal with? What, like, who are your partners with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the community health clinics, you know. It's places like the country doctor, mm-hmm. and you know, the various place, and Harborview a lot of times, because a lot of times it's just, you know, emergency care that people wind up getting. There isn't nearly enough of that stuff, particularly stuff that's proactive, you know. Mostly it's stuff that's responding to people's emergencies rather than, you know, creating a kind of a context for health for people. We've always been really clear that we're not a social services agency. We don't do any kind of direct social services, but we refer people and try to help people get into services that they're looking for when they ask for it.
Right. And I know you've had some health education classes for the vendors, just in
We have, and you know, there's stuff that kinds of comes and goes that we do. We try various experiments and see what resonates with people.
Right. So, can you give like one particular story, or like one particular like vendor or person or situation that really stands out to you?
Yeah, I mean, there's
years?
Several. There's well, I'll talk about Ed McLean since I'm like here in the University District. Ed McLean died maybe 2 years ago of lung cancer. But he was one of our founding vendors. He was involved from the very beginning, and he sold at the University District Safeway. And he was a kind of an iconic vendor for us because he was very, very regular about being there. He was at that Safeway, you know, more than 60 hours a week, and was a sort of a University District institution. And you know, he was somebody who, when he started selling the paper, was addicted. He was using crack, and he had a very, very difficult history. He went to prison, I think when he was 14 or 16, for murder. He was involved in a store robbery in Chicago where he shot and killed somebody, and he went to prison. And he had has this amazing history where he was in and out of prison through his late 30s, because once he got out of prison for that and had gotten a degree in political science, I think, either political science or sociology, he came to the conclusion that as a black man in America with a criminal history, it was going to take a lot more than his little BA in sociology to get him on a career path. So he became an international drug runner and did that until he went back to prison. And by the time he landed in Seattle, he was living in shelters, working a little bit, but getting fired pretty often because he had anger management problem and the addiction, and he started selling the paper, and his life changed. You know, he found that people cared about him. He found that he was building a lot of relationships. He got himself into an apartment through selling the paper with the help of his customers. There was a customer who gave him, I think, $500 or something like that to help him get his first apartment. And he had this sort of aha moment that he told me about, and that a lot of people have told me about, where, you know, one night he was sort of alone in his misery and he did the math. He was like, I'm making a lot of money selling this paper and I've got absolutely nothing to show for it because I'm spending it all on crack, so I should stop. And he did. And, you know, nobody else has been able to be successful as he was on that corner. Since he died, and it's because Ed was a big personality, and he came out of, like, you know, the prison and growing up in Chicago, and there's all these people at that store on that sidewalk. You know, there's the panhandlers, there's the drug dealers, there's all kinds of stuff going on there. And Ed was able to rule that. He was able to basically call the shots and control all of that as a space for him to sell the paper. He had a big enough personality to be able to do that, and it's why he was so successful. And the other thing about Ed, which is really very touching to me personally, is that when Ed started, Ed was all about Ed. You know, I would ask him to be a leader as a vendor, to get involved with the political work, to help other vendors be successful selling the paper, and he would be, screw those people, I don't care about them. And then in the last 3-4 years that he sold the paper, when he would come in and buy his 500 or 600 papers a week that he would buy to sell, he would put down money to buy another bundle of papers that he would just leave on the books for other vendors. So that if somebody came in and didn't have any money to get started selling the paper, I mean, we'd give them their first papers for free, but say somebody's already a vendor and is in a bad way, it was this sort of Ed McLean slush fund that paid for us to be able to give those people papers.
Nice. So he started giving back.
And his stepdaughter has continued that tradition since Ed passed. She has been donating to Real Change so that we can continue to do that for people.
Nice. So a story that definitely stands out to you. And he was with you kind of from the beginning,
on? He got involved in like 95, early 95.
Early on.
So within the first 6 to 8 months, he got involved in the paper and it was our top seller for more than a decade. This guy was on his own, moving between 2,000 and 3,500 papers a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
A lot of papers. So he was housed after he got his apartment.
He was housed he got an apartment and he stayed there. He had an apartment in the Lakewood area. And when he was dying of cancer, I visited him a number of times there. And he was very clear, you know. He was kind of a materialistic guy. Mm-hmm. And he gave me the tour of his apartment. You know, he opened the closet and there was this closet full of suits and beautiful hats and shoes. And he was like, I was able to buy all of this with what I earned from Real Change.
And was he able to access fairly decent health care?
Able to access health care, but, I mean, he died alone and on heavy pain meds in his apartment. He had a nurse that was coming in to check on him. But, he didn't have a good death.
That's a shame. So, so no, like hospice.
No,
not really.
No, that's what would have been best. But you know, he got the oxygen tank and the morphine, and a nurse that checked up on him once in a while, and he spent his last several weeks just basically alone in his apartment in pain, waiting to die.
Mm. So, do you have any other vendors that you know that get access to, like Jefferson Tower, the hospice program that's associated with Harborview?
Or, you know, I'm kind of the wrong person to talk about that because, frankly, I'm just not as close to the ground with the vendors as I've been in the past.
Right.
These days, I focus more on community relations and fundraising, and I would need to get somebody from vendor services who still has the day to day contact.
Right. Yeah. I just understand it's got like a waiting list, just like any other services. It's good, but more people need that than their beds.
Yeah, I'm constantly appalled at just how scarce those sort of critical services are for people and how really broken things are, particularly around mental health. You know, there just isn't anywhere near the resources and addiction treatment. There's been big cuts from the state over the last 3 or 4 years in both mental health and addiction services, and we're seeing the effects on the streets. And one of the things that I find encouraging is organizations like the Downtown Seattle Association, the Seattle Hotel Association, people like that that have in the past pushed for, you know, really short-sighted pseudo-solutions like the panhandling ordinance and have been part of that kind of push toward criminalization of the visible underclass. What I've seen over the last few years is those organizations really coming around to a sophisticated understanding that those sorts of responses don't work, that they're very short-term and probably create a cycle that just creates more of what they're concerned about. And they've become real advocates for more mental health services, for more addiction services, real advocates for the LEAD program, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, which adds a sort of social services dimension to the police response on low-level vice crime, you know, low-level drug dealing, prostitution, mm-hmm. helps to get people into services that, you know, can change their life and get them in a better direction rather than just throwing them in jail and compounding things and making it worse. And we have, you know, a mayor that supports that and a city council that for the most part gets it. And, you know, the environment has really shifted more toward pushing for proactive, longer-term solutions and resisting the easy fixes of arrest and criminalization. So that's, you know, a real positive change that I've seen happen in the last few years. There's a lot of work to do, obviously. We have nowhere near the level of services that we need. But at least, you know, instead of fighting the downtown interests now, we're largely on the same page with them.
So that's something I take it you've been actively working
yeah,
on.
Yeah, and very actively involved in that process.
Yeah, and then also the drug court and mental health court that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And other
efforts. And that's been around for longer, mm-hmm. you know, but it's kind of a different deal, you know. I mean, the issue with drug court and mental health court is that you get into that by basically pleading guilty,
right.
You know, and that's problematic. And that's not really how LEAD works. The way LEAD works is it's really at the cop's discretion, but instead of charging somebody, they've got the option to hold those charges in abeyance completely And give that person an opportunity to engage in social services, to direct, to deal with the behavior on that level.
Right. I guess including the prostitution.
Including prostitution.
Right, that they really changed their approach with that.
Yeah. I mean, the police in Seattle have correctly come around to really seeing prostitutes as victims.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then getting state laws that help to support that
exactly.
as well. Right. So you've kind of touched on this, but what would you say are some of your hopes for the future of kind of safety net health services? And again, health very widely defined in Seattle, King County, nationally as well.
Well, I mean, one of my hopes would be that the federal government get more involved in being part of the solution. The mass homelessness that we're seeing now and that we've seen over the last three decades is, I think, largely a result of pulling back to the commitment on public housing. I saw a statistic once that we've on average lost 10,000 units of public housing a year since the 80s. Exactly.
Right.
I mean, it's happening all over the place.
Yeah.
And, we spend twice as much on housing and tax breaks for middle-class homeowners than we do for public housing for poor people. And that's a problem. And, ever since the 10-year plan started emanating out of D.C. and sweeping mm-hmm. the nation, the big qualifier for that has always been the federal government needs to get meaningfully involved in creating low-income housing for this to work. And thus far, they really have not. So that's a shift that needs to happen if homelessness is ever to become manageable. A shift that's happened here, which is exciting and interesting and needs to be extended, is the recognition that we have a huge and growing number of unsheltered homeless people. The solution to homelessness goes along with the 10-year plan paradigm. That the solution to homelessness is housing first. And the logic has always been that we need to invest in affordable housing and move people as quickly out of shelter into housing and deal with homelessness that way. And because that's cost effective, it saves all of this money in jail and emergency room visits. It's just people respond better when you just get them into housing. That's the place to start.
Mm-hmm.
And that theory is fine, but it is inadequate to the level of homelessness that we've been seeing. We have more people on the street now in Seattle than we ever have. The 10-year plan, I think, got something like, I forget the numbers, 30 or 40,000 people have been moved into housing over the course of the 10-year plan. But at the same time, we have more unsheltered than we ever have. It was a 21% increase last year, a 14% increase the year before. There's a study that's been done, a big deal study done in 2012. I think they looked at some 336 metropolitan areas, and they found that for every $100 average rent increase, you see a 15% increase in homelessness. And,
mm-hmm.
and that's what's been going on in Seattle. The human services infrastructure has not been able to keep up with the basic dynamics that are created by radical inequality and how that plays out in the housing market. So there's a long way to getting around to saying that we have a huge unsheltered problem in this city and that policymakers have begun to understand that we need to meet unsheltered people where they're at. That even if they all went into shelter, for every three homeless people at this point, only one of them is using emergency mm-hmm. shelter transitional housing. Two of them are in shelter transitional housing, and one of them is unsheltered. About a third of our homeless folks are unsheltered and on the street. We're looking more at like programs to help car campers,
right.
Siting tent cities on city property and creating some assistance for that. And all of those things are really in their infancy. But I think, you know, one of the things that I want to see over the next decade is, you know, not only more resources coming from the federal level that are significant and really begin to deal with the problem, and more options around affordable housing and strengthening of tenant rights to deal with the issue on that level, but also recognizing that systemically we're failing a lot of people and that we need to create solutions that meet them where they're at, that are relatively inexpensive, but create safety and community and an entree to the social services system.
Nice. And one other thing, in that, just in terms of like what your hopes for the future are, and you mentioned this earlier on in terms of Boston mm-hmm. and some of the lessons that you learned and burnout. You said that you just kind of burned out on that model.
Right.
So what keeps you going? What do you do that helps to keep you from burning out on all of this work?
Well, you know, I have to qualify my answer to this by saying that I am kind of burnt out right now. You know, I'm about 2 years overdue on a sabbatical that I'm owed, and I think that I'll be taking that within the next year and sort of, you know, stepping back and revitalizing. So, you know, there's that. It's been 21 years that mm-hmm. I've been at Real Change, and much of that time has been spent pushing rocks uphill. So, you know, I'm due for a period of renewal and reflection.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, outside of that, what keeps me going is the vendors. Absolutely, the vendors. I mean, it's just such an enormous privilege to talk to people and see what kind of a difference this organization is making in their lives. People come up to me regularly and tell me that if it wasn't for Real Change, they would be in a very, very hopeless space, and that they're really happy, you know, and they look it, you know, mm-hmm. and that's enormously gratifying. And the other piece that constantly amazes me and I find just awe-inspiring is the huge community of supporters, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, I spend a lot of my time as a fundraiser, and you know, 60% of our budget comes from individual donations. Last year, more than about 2,000 people wrote us checks to support our work, and I get to talk to those people. And I see what we mean to other people in the community, and it's all about the relationships. That's what people really love about Real Change, is the relationships that they're able to create through it. And I've really come to see Real Change as just this vast network of human relationships, where every vendor is a sort of an independent hub mm-hmm. of relationship. And that's how I visualize it. And that's just endlessly cool. I mean, who wouldn't want to get up every day and go to work doing that? So, you know, and the people I work with are absolutely fantastic. We have the best board and staff ever, and it's just a joy to go to work and be with the people that I get to be with.
Nice. But you just want a sabbatical to kind of step back and reflect on what you want to do next.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's always the question for me of not to get too woo-woo about it, but what am I meant to be doing? Mm-hmm. You know, I go in and out of these periods that are kind of like these high points for me where I feel like what I'm doing is completely aligned with who I am and what the universe is demanding of me. And then all these sort of synchronicities start happening mm-hmm. that tell me that I am in that space. And, you know, I haven't really been in that space for a few mm-hmm. years. And I need to figure out how to find my way back to that. And I'm sure that I will. And people don't stay in that space forever. It kind of comes with the deal. You move in and out of it. Life is not one big peak experience.
Right.
But, you know, that's always the question for me is how do I find my way to that space?
Nice. So in the final question, anything that I haven't asked you that you would want to add that you wish I'd asked you about?
Well, let me think about that. I'm sure that there's something. Well, I mean, there's the obvious thing that people can find us online at realchangenews.org mm-hmm. and that we are very much a volunteer-driven organization. I mean, we have a professional staff. We've got 17 people on staff, but we also have more than 200 volunteers who help us in various ways. We've got a full-time volunteer coordinator whose job it is to find things for people to do, and we're pretty good at that. So if people want to get involved, they should email volunteer@realchangenews.org.
Okay. And I know the Carlson Center here at the UW, that's one of the service learning sites.
Yeah, we have a relationship
students.
With them.
Yeah, students love to do that. So I want to thank you for all the work that you do.
My pleasure.
And also for taking time today to do this interview. It's quite an honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much.